Podcast Guys takes a long view and a long price. Spoilers will be commonplace. Listen.
Good morning, faithful reader.
Welcome, fortunate seeker.
This is Podcast Guys Talking Erratic Errata.
Podcast Guys Talking Erratic Errata is a whirlwind reread of A Practical Guide to Evil and has never been anything else, where
a historian
and a literature scholar
tackle the big questions about one of the greatest novels of the age, such as,
did Eris lose a demon?
Why did they not simply amputate the rebellion entirely and graft on a fully functional replacement?
And Eris?
More like blood mess, am I right?
The price you take on negotiations is to slam a severed head on the table and smile at your interlocutor until they reconsider their position. Procopia Lacani, First Hierarch of the League of Free Cities. At your own risk. So this chapter opens with breakfast and ends with a command to undermine and destroy. And in between, a girl, her dad, and her worst enemy slash maybe lover have a measured discussion. A discussion measured, to be clear, in Leaders of Blood Lost.
Right. Yeah, we begin with just Eris chomping some sausage and eggs, which is a pretty solid way to start a chapter. And Kat comes across her and is immediately haunted by Eris, you know, saying, what, you couldn't get a good night's sleep? And we get Kat's internal, her thoughts here, where she first tightens her fingers. She doesn't clench them. She tightens them, so close. And then she says that she refused to fall for a provocation that obvious. And then immediately says, one of these days I am going to find something precious to you and I am going to break it. Now, a trained diplomat I am not, but my understanding is if somebody needles at you and your response is to instantly escalate to violent threats, you have fallen for the provocation. Right?
Yes.
Thanks. I don't know. It's just Kat being very sure I'm not going to fall for that and then immediately falling for it is, you know, it's pretty Kat.
And she does this very openly because Catherine cannot control herself in any way. But we must remember that Eris, despite possibly having to sometimes very clearly not show her hand rather than not show that she's not showing her hand, is very able to not show her hand. And so when Eris replies, oh, I don't doubt you'll try, she replied with a friendly smile that never reached her eyes. So there's this thing that I've read. I am not an animal person. I am, in fact, a person. But I'm given to understand that house cats meow the way they do in order to get human attention. They're effectively shouting in the ranges we can hear because that is how you communicate with the great primate that serves you. And even though it seems...
I was going to say, that's also my understanding, yeah.
And even though it seems that, you know, a meow. Yeah. If I want something, I also make mouth noises. It's a simple little thing. From the cat's perspective, it's a straight-up scream. I think what Eris does here is exactly the same. She has given a friendly smile, and by allowing it not to reach her eyes, she's broadcasting at the widest frequencies she knows how. I'm not actually pleased here. I am a cold, steely threat, and we're fighting. And Catherine's barely picking up.
Right. Eris is doing everything she can. Actually, everything she can. There's no way that her training, her upbringing would allow her to explicitly say these things. So, yeah, she's being as obvious as she possibly can. And, yeah, Catherine is also doing her best, I guess.
And you know, as long as you try your best, lots of people are going to die.
That's true. Catherine notices right away here that Uba is wearing different armor than she was the other day, but still very fancy, expensive armor, all colorful and shiny. It's silver enameled. And she says that it reminds her of what the nobles wear, and asks, "Is this is how the Precy armies used to look before the reforms?" The description she uses is like a flock of tropical birds girded in steel, as beautiful as they were poisonous. First, are there poisonous birds in Prace? Because yikes.
Knowing praise, I have the answer.
Yeah.
Obviously, though.
And second, she's commenting on how fancy and shiny and colorful they would have been. And weirdly, I think it's interesting in that the colorful stuff isn't just expensive for the sake of it. It also would be some of the more practical armor out there, just because it's going to be absurdly expensive and protecting people that value themselves very highly. So it's going to be incredibly good armor on top of looking almost silly in how fancy it is, I guess. So Catherine's focused more on the people and the attire as decoration, where in reality the attire itself is also, top of the line armaments for somebody on a battlefield.
She compares this top of the line armament for people on the battlefield with the Legions of Terror, who she describes as decked in sober practical gear. And yeah, they do have sober practical gear. But practical for an army doesn't necessarily mean this is the best of the best because we want to keep all our soldiers alive. This is the economically feasible thing that best meets the line between expense of training soldiers and expense of making armor.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And she's too quick to judge terrible, bad, rich people. Speaking of terrible, bad, rich people are bad and terrible, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, I tend to agree.
And do you know where they get their money?
Slave labor.
Probably in the Hungering Sands. Except, no, not slave labor. No. Why would you say that? That's illegal. They
My
get the
bad.
riches from the Hungering Sands, which are full of precious metals. Precious metals, which we are told are too close to the surface to have been claimed by the dwarves. And I don't know, okay? I don't know all things about Precy geography and Precy gemic culture. But if you're mining gems in the sand, so when I think of a mine, I think, of course, of the classical idea of a mine. You find a cave on the surface and you walk down through twisting chambers, maybe get attacked by a creeper here or there, find a pool of lava to illuminate it, stone all around you except when it's dirt or granite, or this is all a Minecraft joke, everyone. But mines are in rock, right?
I mean, yeah.
But Hungering Sands sound like a desert.
I would imagine so.
And I'm not sure exactly how you mine in a desert effectively, because sand is one of the few blocks affected by gravity, but it's going to be terrible and worse and bad, right?
Well, here's the problem. You're thinking of the word sands here as being the plural of sand, of, it's an area with lots of sand, when in reality, it's just a truncation of the word sandstone.
That's still probably pretty rough to mine in, but
I mean, it's probably not great. I think mining generally probably isn't great.
oh, come on. When have the miners ever complained without getting put down violently?
Yeah.
But I am aware that you can, if you're lucky, retrieve some pretty nice stones from among the sands. Everyone who read DelTora Quest Book 4, The Shifting Sands, knows what I'm talking about, am I right? Now you can go. I had to make a reference.
Okay, no worries. But the word, the way that Catherine describes the Hungering Sands as being a good source of money, basically, they're full of precious metals. Great, that's a normal thing to say. And then she says, "And the wasteland was pregnant with gemstones." That's not a normal thing to say, but it is a fun turn of phrase. I do like the idea that the whole area is pregnant with gemstones.
The longer I dive into that analogy, the right. So
It starts off as like, oh, okay, like it's got gemstones in it. And then you really think about it and it's not great. But it's very fun.
it is fun. And you know who else is having fun, I think?
Who's that?
Amadeus of the Green Stretch, possibly better known by his enemies and victims as Madeline.
Is he here too?
No. But then he walks in, and now he is.
Okay. And when he walks in, Kat notes that he looks very healthy, that there's a vitality to him that had been missing when she'd first stumbled into him in lore. And I think that's neat. He is in the field with an army at this point. He is engaged in a campaign rather than functioning more or less as somewhere between a spy, an assassin, and a recruiter. And now he looks healthier. Kat says that, you know, she mentions that he's not tan, even though he's been outside, but he's healthier. So she seems to be implying that it's because he's been spending time outside. I think it's probably because he's doing army stuff. He's on a campaign. He's leading soldiers. He's planning battles. And I think his name probably likes that. His name is built around doing that. And so it makes him function better, feel better, look healthier.
I think that's a very strong theory. And it does back up what happens next, because he is just in fine form. He says Catherine. Catherine says Black. Eris says Lord Black, because she's not, you know, some provincial Callowin. She starts rising. She says it's a pleasure to. And, you know, he responds in very Black fashion.
Yeah. He flicks his eyes towards her and says, "Ram it into your hand." And when I say says, I mean he speaks. And he will do this again in just a moment. He'll, as she tries to defend herself, he'll say, "With." Because what's happened here is Black has spoken to Eris and forced her to stick a knife through her hand, pinning her hand to the table. And I think we got to talk about this.
All right.
Because speaking comes up not infrequently, and it's almost always, barring specific exceptions relating to Kat, a named to not named situation. Kat being the exception when somebody who has a name specifically that it functions as a mentor to her name, when the Black Knight speaks to the Squire, and also when Kat can speak to people because she is Kat and the Warden. What is the line that allows that you, once you cross that, you can speak to people? Obviously, it's not something that's just done constantly. It takes a moment in the story where it makes sense. Otherwise, battles just wouldn't happen, since you just have your named walk out and say surrender and the battle's over. So there's got to be some kind of weight to the scene where it happens. You know, it has to be important. And it also has to be, I think, some kind of tie between the people when named are involved here on both sides. Is this, because like the Black Knight and Eris don't particularly have a named based relationship, right? The connection between them is Catherine as a as an apprentice to one, rival to the other. Black does outrank Eris legally. Is that enough here? Is it that she's a transition name and he's not? Is it just that he's the Black Knight and has all that weight of story behind him, and she's this person that people have heard of but isn't that big of a deal yet? Is it that Eris is in a compromised position here, having been talked down the previous night from her plan to nearly wipe Kat out? I don't know. There's a lot of layers to this, and it's interesting every time speaking happens, and I really want to dive into that every time, and I don't really know how to do that. So I'll just leave it open. What are your thoughts?
One thing you didn't quite say that I think should be considered among our possibilities here is not just an issue of rank or power in itself, but here rather the power within the current thrust of the story as it is currently happening. It's not necessarily that Black is simply a greater name than Eris, though, yes. This is why EE was so upset that they had been removing power levels from the wiki.
Mm-hmm.
Note for the audience, no, that's not what he said. He said the opposite. Listen to the episode again. It was a really cool day in my life. But instead, right now, Eris and Catherine have had their conflict. It's spent for now. There's not much story between them. And the story hasn't moved on to an intriguey competition where they're bound by the laws of the Empire and the watching eyes of each other's forces, and they need to find an excuse to be able to finally put the knife in the... No. Right now, they're just squabbling kids and Daddy's home. And Daddy, is being daddy here. He is the hand of the Empire. He's the great power who has come in after everything, but, you know, that means now it's over. They have struggled and fought, and now he's here. He is the end of the story, and that he holds the inflection point in his hands. And because of that, he is governing this portion, perhaps.
So it's similar to when two named are fighting, how if the story means that one should win, they have a nudge in, you know, towards victory, something slight goes their way. Speaking is sort of the social side of that, is what you're pointing at?
Proposing.
Sure. I can get behind that. It things get a little more questionable than when there is a named speaking to non-named, to the normies, if you will, because they don't interact with this story directly in the same way. And so then it does feel like it's more just named can do this sometimes. It's just about their personal story rather than the conflict, maybe. But I don't know. I think I'm going to want to talk about this every time speaking happens, to kind of analyze it through the lens of all these speaking we've seen so far and what it seems to say about the ability. It's just such a fascinating tool in the arsenal of a named.
As far as named speaking to those lacking a name goes, now, I know you are, of course, an uncultured boor, wholly unacquainted with the finer things in life, but right. Have you at least heard of the theater?
Like where you watch movies?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Now imagine you were watching the movie as it was being filmed, live.
Like a behind-the-scenes footage on the DVD? Yeah.
Right. And you know how sometimes in the behind-the-scenes footage on the DVD, somebody wearing a green bodysuit lifts up a table, and the table's actually floating in the film because they can fix it in post?
Yeah, that's movie magic, baby.
Right. Well, perhaps named can basically move around the non-named like the props they are. It's not that non-named are irrelevant for a story. It's that they're not figures moving the story. Because stories do absolutely change and turn if I slay the entire town of non-named nobodies, even though none of them matter individually in a story sense in that way. They're props. Let me tell them what to do.
So as long as the prop is part of the story that you are in the midst of, you have some sway over it. So it's not that a named could necessarily speak to anyone at any time, but as long as it is furthering the plot line, I guess, that they're on currently, it just sort of is there as an option.
It is a proposal. Though also, I both agree with might not be able to speak to anyone at any time, while thinking as well, but you know, the kind of named person who would speak to anyone at any time would make speaking to anyone at any time kind of part of their story and maybe be able to pull that off.
I wonder too, but if, yeah, no, I agree there. If there's sort of an unspoken, I don't know, vibe where regardless of, you know, either separate from what we've been talking about or what you've been proposing or alongside that, if named know when they can speak, when there's just if I speak right now, people will obey me, or I'm going to speak right now and I know people will obey me, whichever one of those comes first, actually, whether it's the will or the creation nudge, you know, this internal, yep, this is my time to speak right now. If that's something that just happens, because there are times where it feels like speaking would solve problems and it isn't used. So there must be some kind of internal thing that we just aren't privy to that helps determine when it's possible.
I'd be willing to buy that, if only at a discount.
That's fair.
Where were we in the story? I feel like something had just happened to provoke that conversation.
Yeah, Black just had Eris stab herself in the hand.
Oh, right. Little levity for the chapter. Well, Eris didn't cry out, though her lips thinned. And I know she's a trained, pricey trash queen or whatever, but I gotta say, props to her. Like, she's doing this with style. She comports herself with immense style this entire time. She is utterly thrashed. I do have a fun fact on that. But she is very much handling herself masterfully. But that's Aerith for you. Yeah. Want to learn my fun fact about thrashing?
In a moment. I do want to say... Okay.
I'll do it at a different point then.
Okay. After she is told to twist because her reaction isn't big enough, even then she's got a knife in her hand that she's grinding farther in, and all she does is let out a small hiss of pain. So, yeah, that's just further support for what you're talking about. Holy cow. I cannot imagine. Please, tell me about thrashing.
Nah, you're going to have to wait for another point.
But I want to know about thrashing.
Well, let this be a lesson for you about contributing positively to this podcast people listen to because of you.
After Black does this, he asks Aerith if she understands him. She nods, and he says, "Now thank me for the valuable lesson you were just taught." Hey, title drop. Now we know why the chapter is called that. It's because he made Aerith stab herself.
The chapter is called Valuable Lesson?
It's called Lesson, yes.
And after going through all this, don't you think Aerith has suffered enough?
I do. Kat does not. She, pretty soon after this, after Aerith says, "Thank you, Lord," Kat dives in with, I'm about to go off. Let me start with the obvious stuff. She complains about the demon. She says that doing that alone should be enough for her to be buried in a shallow grave. So she, speaking to Black, says, "So I'd like her head on a pike, pretty please." And I really appreciate that, yes, Catherine was just a poor Callowin not too long ago, but she's now a refined member of the Precy military elite. So she has manners when she asks for people to be beheaded and have their heads displayed on a pike. I just, you know what? That's growth. That's character growth.
Aerith is probably really proud of Catherine at this point, because...
I think so.
That's all she wanted.
All Aerith ever wanted was for Catherine to stay pretty please.
Aerith is given a chance to offer a rebuttal for her life.
Mm-hmm.
But the story she's been preparing, as I mentioned when she first trialed it, is not one that any party sympathetic to Catherine is going to take too seriously. The wards holding the demon were overrun by foreigners. Given Squire's pointless pursuit of the Silver Spears after her victory, it seems obvious who is at fault. And her argument is, Catherine was doing her job. She doesn't point out why it was a bad idea or how Catherine was motivated by revenge rather than military. No, just Catherine was doing the thing that she was supposed to, and then it went wrong. So really, you should have her head. I know she's from the Shoot the Messenger Society, but, you know, this is not the person to make that argument to. She is on her back foot.
Yeah, she was caught out in her plan way worse than she was expecting. And, frankly, is floundering a little bit. She is struggling here to regain her composure. And yet, Catherine is almost impressed, it seems, with her language. She says to us, "Not a single word of that was an actual lie, I was certain." Not that anyone in the room was fooled. But now, so Aerith's speech here is, "I take no responsibility for this." Yep, that's true. She says another sentence that we'll get back to, followed by, "Given Squire's pointless pursuit of the Silver Spears after her victory, it seems obvious who is at fault." Pointless pursuit, probably not a lie, that's fine. Her victory, yep, that's true. "It seems obvious who is at fault." Yep, that's not a lie. But the sentence we skipped over is, "The wards holding the demon were overrun by foreigners." Now, I understand that Aerith is not Callowin. Is she referring to herself as a foreigner here, as though she's trying to have this weird, by the letter of the law loophole in a law that doesn't exist except in convincing people to believe her? It just seems like such a strange thing for Kat to be like, "Yep, there are no lies there," when Aerith did the demon thing by herself of her own accord.
The only answer here is Catherine doesn't know.
But Catherine does know.
Actually, the only answer here is Catherine hears the word foreigner and just assumes that means Precy.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, that's fair, I guess, from Catherine's perspective. All right. All right, Catherine. You win this time in our ongoing battle for me to prove that you don't know as much as you think you do, I guess, for some reason.
Wow, you sure picked a hard challenge, proving Catherine doesn't know everything she thinks she does.
Yeah, well, you know, that's how I grow as a person, is I set really tough goals for myself and then achieve them constantly and easily.
It doesn't matter whether or not she's telling the truth, even though clearly every word she said is perfectly true 100%, no matter how you view it. Because the question is whether her connection to the True Bloods would be enough to get her off with a slap on the wrist, regardless of guilt.
Her what?
Connections to the True Bloods. You know, like how she's a True Blood.
Yeah, like my connections to the humans.
Oh, do you have anything to do with them?
Yeah, I've got a ton of human connections, in fact.
That does sound like something someone without many human connections would say.
Yeah, okay, you're right.
But we find out the answer to whether and what she can get away with pretty quickly. Survey says.
This is what she can get away with, in fact, letting out a demon, because there hasn't been enough solid proof. Black says that Militia did not give him permission to execute Eris. But this sentence is very important because it tells us that he did ask explicitly. This wasn't a he wasn't given permission, so he's not going to assume, or wasn't given the leeway to make the decision. He was not given permission to execute, which means there was a very specific discussion about this. So I really like that. Even in saying, "Hey, I can't kill you this time," he is letting her know, "I would have liked to have killed you."
I mean, I think it's important to have clear communication in a relationship.
Oh, absolutely.
Even the relationship is girlfriend friend slash mortal foe's dad, girlfriend slash mortal foe.
Okay, I was like, that's just the end of the sentence.
No, it's just a kind of roughly constructed one, unlike any other one I've had on this podcast.
Yeah, normally everything we say is so clear and straightforward, so.
Word, good, it's all happened. So, if Eris had ever been worried, it had not shown on her face, and neither did relief now. The dark-skinned aristocrat inclined her head, murmuring a platitude about Militia's wisdom and foresight. I think it's just a really strong choice not to write the platitude. It demonstrates how important the actual words are. It shows us how much anyone particularly cares about the platitude. It is said. It must be said. It has been said. The ritual is complete.
That's a good point. It is nice to just, hey, some nonsense was said here, but it had to be said. Black follows us up with a warning slash threat about, don't get in the way of imperial interests again, or I will destroy you. You've been careful to toe the line of the law, which is questionable, but Black doesn't know all the details here because Eris did cover her tracks somewhat well enough. And then he says, "You think that because you were towing the line of the law, this affords you a degree of protection?" And he gives a line to her. He says, "I'm a villain, child. The appearance of the rule of law is useful to me, so I have allowed it. Do not mistake this for true fettering. Should you ever inconvenience me again, I will speak three words and you will split your own throat." Now, great little line from him, great speech about his power and where everybody lines up in the hierarchy of Prace here. The threat here is not if you hurt Prace again, if you break the law again, it's if you ever inconvenience me again. But the important thing here is a little bit more information on speaking, which is apparently that you can speak somebody to death. You can order somebody to kill themselves, and Black seems to be confident that that will work. He doesn't seem like the kind of person to just make empty threats in a situation like this. That's pretty strong.
In the interest of being careful, I will say, or at least he is confident enough that he's in the position to give off the impression that, et cetera, but.
Right, but I think that right there is why he knows that this actually would work. If he's in a position where the story is now he's the hand of the Empire and she's not, or the fist of the Empire, and she's not a hero up, you know, a
That's
weak
true.
hero who's climbing up to, she's just another villain. He has the authority, and I think what helps this is even if he didn't speak three words and have her kill herself, he could kill her whenever he wanted to. And that probably lends weight to the speaking because it doesn't matter whether or not it's through speaking or through a sword or any number of other things. She would be dead if he wanted it.
If he wanted it enough.
If he wanted it enough, and also if mommy gave him permission.
Has he betrayed the Empire?
He would never.
And why does he care what Cordelia thinks?
So there's a couple different mommies in this story.
Have I mentioned how much I love this book? Regardless, want some news that nobody in the room is going to love?
Yeah, I do.
Great. Read on a little bit. Skip a bit and then read some. You can probably guess where.
Black tells Eris, in happier news, you and your mercenaries have been attached to the 15th as auxiliaries for the next part of this campaign. Congratulations, you've been granted the equivalent of a commander's commission. He goes through a few other layers of punishment. We've got the knife in the hand. We've got the, hey, I'll kill you if you do this again. We've got the, hey, you're now underneath Catherine, serving as auxiliaries in her army. And there's a few more things to come, but this is just a great piece in the middle of that, of just a little insult to really rub things in. Yep, your whole expeditionary force, your whole plan where you were in command of a wing of the war. Nope, now you're just attached to an understrength legion led by a green commander who you personally hate. All good stuff.
But that isn't even the final insult here. Because he has not been, I would not describe Black's actions throughout this as terribly compassionate towards Eris.
Oh, interesting. Why? I'm curious about your reading that's led you to that conclusion.
Killing someone, saying you're going to kill someone isn't nice.
All right, that's a good point. I'll concede that one.
Fantastic. However, he just delivers that piece of news, waits a moment, and then says, well, what are you still doing here? A mere commander is not cleared for this kind of meeting. You are dismissed. Which is so dismissive. Literally, he dismisses her. But it's so dismissive. He is utterly thrashing her. Are you ready for the fun fact now? Or are you going to keep misbehaving?
No, I'd love to hear it.
So I was writing about bread for work. And I was learning about how you prepare wheat for bread. And it's, you beat it up a whole bunch, and then you grind it up a whole bunch, and then you cook it up a whole bunch, and then you eat it. And the first step where you beat it up a whole bunch is, as we know, called threshing, where you separate the wheat from the chaff. Do you know another word for threshing?
I'm sure you'll tell me.
Thrashing.
Oh.
Which is actually great. And this just makes me happy.
Why are so many of our, like, core pieces of production based on, even in 2024, just kind of beating something up enough until it's worn down to where you can use it? Like, don't you have to pretty aggressively attack wool to turn it into a usable material? Also true for seeds and wheat or various grains. Kind of seems like we just like beating things up.
Well, you have identified one of the fundamental flaws of humanity, but also, very importantly, I need to note, you don't really have to worry about the wool part unless you're some kind of chump who's wearing wool. I don't know about you, but my clothes are produced primarily through something approximating slave labor and forged of pretty much just microplastics that every time I wash them go into the water supply. And it's a really bad thing, and something needs to be done. It's really bad. And pretty much everyone listening to this is also guilty of consumption under capitalism in a globalized state.
And I hope you all feel terrible for that.
It is worth some analysis. I'll give it that much. So, Eris goes, and when she does, there's a little task that needs to be done, because she is kind of knifed to the table.
Yep.
You know how it goes. Get up, wrench out your knife, and go. And she has conducted herself so well so far, but she's making a pretty big faux pas here, because she's just bleeding over everything.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of gross. And so as she goes with her hand hole dripping, there's the tiniest flare of magic and the bleeding stems. One, oh cool, I think this might be some of the first auto-healing we see. And two, this feels to me like a concession she has to make in order to maintain a propriety of not bleeding all over the place. Because I don't think she would at all do any healing in front of people. She would not be half so gauche as to reveal a vulnerability if not for the fact that she was leaving blood all over the place, which is just not done.
It's probably a concession because she has to decide either further lower herself in front of Black and Catherine, where she's already been pretty well threshed, or leave this enclosed area and let the army and her servants and other people who are beneath her see her with a hole in her hand bleeding all over the place. And then that's shame in front of two things, somebody above you and everybody below you. So I think she increases the shame here to prevent it elsewhere.
Poor girl.
But don't worry, it gets increased in here again, because as she's leaving, Black stops her and says, one last thing, you've made a mess. Come back in here later with a rag and bucket and clean this up. So just another layer of insult to literal injury here. But in this one, Black says, one last thing, Eris, you've made a mess all over Catherine's table. The subtle expansion of the insult by using her name here rather than saying, you know, her first name or not using a title or a name at all to remind her, yeah, you're named, but I'm still having you come in here with a rag and bucket and cleaning up your own blood that I forced you to spill by your own hand. There's just some layering going on there. Black does this very well. It is masterful.
Not by her own hand, from her own hand. You're both. A little confused.
Hand to hand. I think
our position's fun.
They are.
They really are. But I do have to say, in a way that totally won't be justified later or anything, that Black just seems to be going way too hard here. Like, hasn't she had enough? Seriously, this is not productive. You don't want to just burn every possible bridge. They could not possibly work together at this point in any way. And, I mean, she's a potent, if transitional, named. I don't think you want to make an enemy of her so explicitly outright when, until recently, she was hoping to ally herself to you. And without a better reason, Black is definitely making a mistake here.
You're forgetting, though, something that's very important.
Okay.
Unlike you, Black is not a coward.
You know, I want to argue, but Black is, in fact, so bold, he doesn't even mind ignoring the way words work entirely.
Oh?
Black and Kat are now together, and Black looks at her leg, which is messed up. This is a fact. Mm-hmm. Immutable. Now. And she says, Masego said it can't be fixed. And he replies, inaccurate. If we amputate the leg entirely, you can be grafted a fully functional replacement. You know, it actually can be fixed. All we have to do is remove it and use something else, thereby fixing it. Hey, you know how you totaled your car? It isn't totaled. You can buy a new one. Easy.
Yeah.
Follow for more fun life hacks.
That is a good one. Do you have any other useful ones for me? Just off the cuff here?
Yeah.
Okay.
Your brain isn't broken and can't be fixed. It's just seasonal depression. Go in the sunlight.
Have you tried being happier?
No, actually, go in the sunlight, because it doesn't cure depression or anything, but I gotta say, when spring rolls around, life is less bad, or maybe even good. Have you been outside? Everyone in the Northern Hemisphere, go look at a flower. They're pretty nifty. Unless, you might find a bug in it. It might bite you.
Unless you don't suffer from any kind of sad, capital letter sad here, not the emotion, and the outside doesn't affect your mood, in which case this is bad advice.
Yes, it's bad to look at a flower unless you have neurological issues.
Right. That's what I just
psychological,
said.
Psychological.
Yeah.
Brainological.
Don't look at flowers unless you're depressed. How many ways do you want me to say this?
That does explain Ophelia and Hamlet being so obsessed with flowers. However, much like the limb of the tree Ophelia was crawling across when it broke off and she fell into the water and drowned. Uh-huh. Spoiler alert for Hamlet. Other limbs can also be vulnerable. I am prouder than I've ever been.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, so the reason that this isn't what happens, the reason that Kat doesn't get her limb replaced by an arcane prosthesis here, is that limb grafts made by magic can be unmade by the same, according to Black. It would be a liability against any sorceress named. It's interesting here because basically what's being said here is she has to choose between a particular vulnerability to sorceress named or a broader vulnerability to more martial focused named as well as normal people. She's giving up agility and strength and speed so that she doesn't have a weakness to magic. I gotta say, I think she made the right choice, but it's interesting that, you know, she had that choice here, that she had to choose a weakness to one side or the other, and picked.
And she does pick fast.
Oh, yeah.
Directly after Black finishes his sentence, Catherine replies, blah, 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 against any sorceress named. Pass, then, I grunted. She knows what she's about. Let's see what's next. What's next? Is there... Oh.
Uh-oh.
So, you know when I was talking about how clever Black was being with the way he was really pushing Eris, and I thought that was such a good move, and I spoke well of him because I'm clever and on the same page?
Yeah, I remember something like that. I wasn't really paying attention to your old thing.
Our hand, which I share with Black, none of Black's heavy-handed interventions, the hand here is a pun because of stabbing, were for Catherine's benefit, he says. Rather, he was attempting to frighten Eris enough that she'd let out the demon. You know, that thing you really want her to do? How they've been fighting for a few chapters to get the demon out in the open?
So, remember earlier when I said Black's not a coward? That's still true, but now I have concerns for his self-preservation instincts.
Well, what if I told you that you wouldn't... It seems way out of character, but what if Black had a plan?
He is Mr. Plan.
Yeah, it turns out, Warlock.
I guess that's a pretty good plan.
Yeah. And then he threatens a child.
Ooh.
And after they discuss how they were hoping to catch Eris in the act and get her, he says to Catherine, if I believed in corporal punishment, you'd be cradling your cheek right now. He's upset with her, because apparently she did something dumb when she, against all advice, went into her soul and confronted a demon in the worst possible way, place, and with no preparation in order to try to force something to happen that was going to happen anyway, but instead she lost all opportunity for her aspect because, come on, Catherine, stop.
And don't forget, she stacked on top of that with choosing to stand and fight against said demon outside of her soul, too, rather than running.
Good job.
Yeah.
Black's upset.
Mm-hmm.
And yells at her. And nothing really comes of that. Other than, hey, get good. But I'm glad someone is willing to say it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he is her mentor, but he is also the Black Knight and a villain and is very willing to be like, I'm very upset with you right now. But the takeaway here is not, therefore, you are a failure and it's not everything's collapsing, but rather, be better. This cannot happen. This simply cannot happen.
And this is one of the good parenting tips that we get from Practical Guide to Evil. Parents, don't slap your kids and call them bad. Lovingly correct them.
Yeah.
Like, actually, it's not hard. Parenting as a whole thing is hard. But, like, every step's pretty straightforward.
Don't hit your kids. Help. Yeah.
Black does Catherine a big favor and sucks up all of the recruits around and puts them in her army. They'll be waiting for her.
Great.
But they'll be green.
Oh, they're orcs?
No. They're already going to be wading along the river, so because of the spray of the water, they're going to grow moss.
Ooh, gross.
Well, you know, moss grows fat on a rolling stone, but that's not how it used to be when the jester played for the king and queen and the Coty Bar from Dune Scene and a voice that came from you and me. All that said, Black suggests that's not the biggest issue because she's got a core of refined, battle-tested troops. And they have been through a bit, two bits, actually. But a few rough days does not, I think, the strongest backbone make, really, that it's not nothing. But, you know, it's been a little month or something. I'm making up the time.
Yeah, it has been. But Black's comment here that she now has a fantastic fighting force, one of the best in the Empire. The thing is with armies like this is... One of the main things that determines effectiveness is, or a couple of main things, are like cohesion and willingness to stand and fight, and ignoring things like PTSD or equivalent. An army that has stood its ground against devils and a very effective mercenary force, and also a very effective mercenary force that has been corrupted by demons and is, you know, supplemented with devils, has proven that it has cohesion and is willing to stand and fight. and has proven, like, the individuals have proven to themselves that they can, there aren't going to be too many things going forward that are going to be worse than what they've seen so far. These legionaries are not going to say...
Well, there shouldn't be, at least.
Well, okay. Yeah. I mean, as far as from Black's point of view here, from, like, the point of view of people in this moment, they're going to go up against other soldiers, and the thought process will be, well, at least it's not devils again, or at least it's not a melted pile of horse flesh again.
It is Callow. I'm sorry. I hate to keep arguing with you, but...
Oh, yeah, that's fair, too. She does have... Yes, it's been a very short amount of time, and these may not be the best individual fighters because of that. They don't have the experience to do that sort of thing. They may not have the... You know, they may not be the best in the world when it comes to perfect formations or drills, but when it comes to standing and fighting, they very well might be the best in the Empire.
But that's the other thing. Black argues the legionaries who fought against the kingdom are getting old. You might well have the sharpest fighting force in the Empire under your command at the moment. And Catherine thinks, yeah, the goblins back then are dead. The older human and orc soldiers are retired or behind desks. Am I wrong in thinking she was kind of slow getting into this conflict? Like, other legions have been in the thick of things. Maybe martial law in a city, maybe killing Callowans. Not for sport this time, but it's still funny.
But the other legions that have been involved here have been garrison duty, rooting out insurgents, basically, fighting small-scale skirmish. Like, have there been... pitched field battles aside from the Three Hills? And more importantly, no one else had to fight devils.
That was a devil of a time.
And actually, on top of that, even without the devil thing, Kat fought against professional soldiers with excellent equipment. Most of the other legions, if they were fighting battles, would be going up against what? Callowan levies? There's also a pretty stark difference there.
Fair. Especially since disagreeing with you would mean I have to say something good about Callow.
Yeah, heaven forbid.
More like below forbid, am I right? Yeah.
So, following this, Black takes a moment and says, look, I don't want to, you know, he says, I don't mean to dismiss your accomplishments, Catherine. You've made mistakes, but you've also won repeated victories against horrendous odds. What you did for Marchford, the story you've created with your action, is something that will ripple across Callow in the years to come. You've taken the first step forward in the path you set for yourself. That is something to be proud of. So he reams her, he threshes her for a little bit, and then he says, but you're doing great, and you are, as far as the name stuff, as far as setting up stories, you're killing it. And I don't have a lot to say here. My main comment is just, aww, look at Black being a dad. This is so great.
Other parenting tip, just be great, like Black.
Just be like Black, yeah. That's really what it is.
But Catherine has not had this kind of support in her life before, and so she tries to find a way to still be in trouble. She talks about the problems she still has, like breaking her name for no reason.
Yeah, which Black says is a minor loss. He's more upset about the risk she took than the results of it, which is okay, Black. Kat has a better response to it. I permanently damaged my name, Black, crippled the amount of power I can use by at least a third, and then the word she uses here is until I come into another name. I like that confidence. Not unless I come into another name, but until I do. Good for you, Catherine.
We'll see if it actually happens. Spoiler alert, it really almost doesn't, yeah. Despite.
That's true.
So, if I say Fields of Strege, what do you think of?
You know, the big battle where Callow died.
Right. But what if I reminded you that there were actually more events called the Fields of Striges?
I guess that's not particularly surprising. It seems like a pretty important place for battles to take place.
The previous Black Knight, Black explains to Catherine that raw power is not everything, and he's actually a big old weakling, and he's also the most powerful, so checkmate. His predecessor was super strong, but got murdered.
Oops.
But where he got murdered was the first Fields of Strigus.
Oh.
So, yeah. I kind of end up forgetting that that was anything other than the death of the kingdom and the end of all happiness and hope. And worst of all, the start of Catherine Foundling, whom I do love.
Same. And so does Black, even if he phrases things oddly sometimes.
But he... So true.
He says, in reassuring Catherine, I guess, the following sentence, and I want to tell you, before I read it, he's phrasing this as though it is a good thing, a positive thing for Catherine. You make mistakes because of who you are, Catherine, not because of what your name drives you to do. No, 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 don't worry, Catherine. It's not the super powerful thing that you have access to that makes you bad. It's you, personally. You're bad. And this is reassuring because you can get better, I guess. It's just such a backhanded compliment, and I love it.
Well, that's black for you. You know, always a bleeding hand. Heart. Bleeding Ooh, heart.
Nice.
Right. Well, speaking of his hand, his fingers tap against the wood, the rhythm that of an old Calowan funerary march. So pick your ground. Surround her, tire her out, and then let her do the rest. They're talking about beating Eris. But the amount of drama in this ostensibly purely practical man.
I love it. The rhythm of a funerary march is such a metal thing to just start drumming your fingers to while talking to your apprentice.
And specifically a Calowan one.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know, with black, you've probably been to a lot more Calowan funerals than Bracey.
Do you think Black goes to Calowan funerals?
He went to Calo's funeral.
Nice, that's true. Unfortunately, though, that
we are surrounded, tired out, and now I'll let you do the rest.
It's all the time we have for today.
Join us next week on Podcast Guys Talking Erratic Errata as we discuss
heuristics,
logistics,
and economics.
And maybe hermeneutics?
Wait in their blood. I don't think so. I know you wanted to get that in there. I don't think so.
Podcast Guys Talking Erratic Errata is a fan-made podcast discussing Erratic Errata, a practical guide to evil. Check out the full serial at practicalguidetoevil.wordpress.com. Intro music for this episode was The Cradle of Your Soul by Lemon Music Studio. Music for the epigraph was Corporate Climb by Alex Productions. Outro music, which even now is elevating my voice to the realms of the divine, is Price of Freedom by Daddy S Music. The music is provided by the generous license of pixabay.com/music. Go and support all the artists who make this work possible by providing their stories and sounds free of charge. If you'd like to support this podcast, follow us on Twitter at The Long Price. Do you have questions, comments, contributions? Are you overwhelmed by the urge to correct our ostensible errors? Email us at thelongprice@gmail.com. If you'd like to materially support our work, find our Patreon at patreon.com/pgtee. Join the ranks of our patrons and be called by name, receive personalized stories and art, and access at least one patron-exclusive tangent. We implore you don't consider joining unless you're already supporting the artists who make this all possible. Special thanks to our patron and villainous hero, Gray, our patron and liege, always claimant, never the named, our patron and guardian, the pain knight, our patron and mentor, the traveling teacher, our patron and dear friend, Aaron, our patron and inspiration, the hopeful romantic, as well as the hordes of cattle below. Next week, Chapter 35, Spur.